Each year at the Unitarian Universalist General Assembly, one of the highlights is always the where lecture. Now, if I had more than about 20 minutes or so, I could give you all the details of why it's called the where lecture. The short of it is there were three generations of highly influential Unitarian ministers with the last name Ware. And so we have the where lecture. It's been given since 1922, and past Ware lecturers include Reinhold Niebuhr, Howard Thurman, Saul Alinsky, Kurt Vonnegut, Elaine Pagels, Mary Oliver, Karen Armstrong, and many other luminaries. If you're interested, you can read almost all of the transcripts of those past Ware lecturers online on the UUA website. In 1966, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was the Ware lecturer. He delivered a lecture titled "Don't Sleep Through the Revolution" to the gathered Unitarian Universalists in that assembly that year was in Hollywood, Florida. He said, "There are some things in our nation and in our world to which I am proud to be maladjusted." Now, we're used to hearing that word maladjusted as it's a problem. You go to a therapist if you're maladjusted to something. But King was saying there's things that he's proud to be maladjusted to. He said, "And I call upon you to be maladjusted and for all people of goodwill to be maladjusted to these things until the good society is realized." He said, "I never intend to adjust myself to segregation and to discrimination. I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few and leave millions of people perishing on lonely islands of poverty amidst a vast sea of prosperity. Yes, I must confess that I believe firmly that our world is in dire need of a new organization called the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Maladjustment." Today, almost five decades later, we are right to be maladjusted to a criminal justice system that has failed to provide justice for Michael Brown, for Tamir Rice, for Eric Garner, and for so many other people of color. Relatedly, a colleague recently reminded us that as familiar as we are with another of MLK's speeches, the "I Have a Dream" speech, especially that soaring peroration at the end, we are much less familiar with the rest of his speech that day, which includes, among other things, this line: "We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality." That was part of King's dream. As I said last Sunday, for more context on the strong parallels between the situations that led to the rise of the civil rights movement and today, I strongly recommend Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow: Mass Incarceration in an Age of Colorblindness. As some of you will recall, the foreword to that important book is written by Dr. Cornel West, a contemporary prophetic voice for racial justice. In light of recent protests in Ferguson, in Cleveland, in New York City, and across the country, I was pleased to see that the 2015 Ware Lecture in Portland, Oregon, at the UU General Assembly this summer in June, will be Dr. Cornel West. And I think in many ways he'll help pick up and extend that vision of creative maladjustment that King spoke about in 1966. One of my favorite quotes from Cornel West is that justice is what love looks like in public. Justice is what love looks like in public. We should never intend to adjust ourselves to conflicts between police and citizens that so quickly and unnecessarily escalate to the use of deadly force, especially when there's a long-term pattern of racial violence. And that's not to say that all police officers are bad. Indeed, quite the opposite is the case. But both police officers and ourselves are caught in a broken, racially biased system. And our second UU principle calls for justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. And our second source is the words and deeds of prophetic men and women, which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, with compassion, and with the transforming power of love. I shared with you one framework for creative maladjustment a few weeks ago in a sermon on the transformative power of recognizing the inherent worth and dignity of every person, every human being. And that includes recognizing that we, too, each of us, has inherent worth and dignity. And in that sermon, I shared the results of a study of 2,500 people who have been imprisoned for murder. When asked why they felt compelled to kill, the majority of the inmates responded, "Because I felt disrespected." That's why they killed. In contrast, during this morning's spoken meditation, you heard a second framework for creative maladjustment. The powerful testimonies from both facilitators and graduates and participants of the Alternatives to Violence Project, which seeks to equip prison inmates, school children, and community members with tools to diffuse conflicts and respond with nonviolence. We heard yet another framework for creative maladjustment in the Dharma talk last Sunday from Bhante Sujatha, the Buddhist monk who was here, and shared with us the powerful practice of metta, M-E-T-T-A, loving kindness meditation, in which you can just pause and take the time throughout the day to say these words to yourself. May I be filled with loving kindness. May I be at peace. May I be well. And then to extend that in one concentric circle out to the people around you. May you be filled with loving kindness. May you be peaceful and at ease. May you be well. And then finally, extending that out to all beings, may we be filled with loving kindness. May we be peaceful and at ease. May we be well. And Bhante spoke about the power of just, I mean, I don't know how long that took me, but 30 seconds maybe, and that can completely change the way that you are in the world, and by trying to inculcate that loving kindness meditation. It can be an amazing way to center yourself, to shift your perspective on your experience, and to reconnect compassionately with yourself, with the world around you, and with the people around you. And while there are vital systemic changes that we need to make to reform our criminal justice system, this morning I want to share with you one more framework for creative maladjustment that you can apply immediately in your own life, even as we also work for those larger changes. These insights are from the Center for Nonviolent Communication, founded by psychologist Michael Rosenberg. My hope is to increase awareness that even when we're in conflict or find ourselves in the midst of conflict, and that can be physical, but it can also be verbal when we find ourselves getting a little sharp, a little snarky, our tone gets sharp, our voice starts raising, that we can start to realize that there are healthier, more compassionate ways of responding. And at first, that may happen like 10 days later. It may be, you know, I was a little violent in my communication. I need to go try to reconcile that and restore a right relationship. And then maybe it'll start happening 10 minutes after you just had a not particularly nonviolent communication. And then you'll find over time, as you start to practice whichever of these techniques feel valuable to you, that maybe in the middle of yelling at someone, you'll stop yourself. And then eventually you start to get to the root of violence within ourselves. The three main steps in Dr. Rosenberg's method for nonviolent communication, the first is to just simply observe what is happening in the situation and to do it without judgment and to do it without evaluation. The second is to state how we feel as we observe this action, and the third is to say what needs of ours are underneath those feelings. What needs are underneath the feelings. As you can perhaps guess, this actually sounds kind of easy to do. It's much more difficult in theory. If you ever have an interaction with someone you have a conflict with and videotape it, and then go back and watch it, and see if you were able to just observe what was happening without judgment, without evaluation, you'll find that it's very, very, very hard to do. And if you can't see it, ask them to point out where the evaluation and the judgment came in beyond the objective observations. And not all of us, of course, with that second step are in touch with our feelings, much less experienced with identifying those deep needs underneath the feelings. So it's much easier said than done. But Rosenberg's books, such as Nonviolent Communication and Living Nonviolent Communications, are really good starting points. He gives a ton of examples, a ton of dialogues. I'll just give you three this morning. So see if you can hear and notice the difference between the examples of observations with evaluations mixed in, and the other side I'll give you, the ones separate from evaluation and judgment. So what's the difference between you are too generous? Do you hear how definitive and judgmental you are this thing? Not you might be this thing, you are too generous. Versus when I see you giving all your money to others, I think you're being too generous. Using I language, and it's saying what I think versus what you are. He procrastinates. Do you hear the judgment in there? Verses. I've only seen him study for exams the night before. Do you see the difference? Because you haven't seen that person 24/7 unless you're the NSA, right? So, you never do what I want versus the last three times I initiated an activity, you said you didn't want to do it. So, you never do this versus the last three times you didn't. So, the difference between what you can objectively say through observation without evaluation and judgment. It's really hard, but it can be a really powerful way to not immediately start people on the defensive, which is what happens when you introduce that judgment and evaluation. So it's about slowing down, it's about taking responsibility for specifically naming what we objectively observe and trying as much as possible to bracket out our subjective evaluations, especially at first, and restraining ourselves from imputing judgments and motives onto people when we don't know them for sure. Because, of course, after Freud and what psychology tells us is that we're unconscious of our motivations most of the time, at least the fullness of them. So most assuredly, we do not know the full extent of what's going on inside someone else and all of their history and while they're doing what they're doing. Moreover, Freud and other psychologists also caution us to beware of the ways that we unconsciously project our own feelings and repressions onto other people. So if you notice yourself having a particularly exaggerated reaction to someone, so they're doing something and all of a sudden you're going from 0 to 60 and how triggered you are by it, that's probably as much about your stuff as it is about their stuff. So that's your flag to say, let me step back, objectively observe what's going on, what feelings am I having, and what's really the need that's going on underneath that. It's what's called the 90% of the iceberg that is underneath the surface. You need to get in touch with that, not just the 10% above the surface. And one of Rosenberg's best tips for taking responsibility for your subjective experience, which is, of course, very real inside yourself, is not only the classic advice of use I statements, but also to make sure the word I also follows the word because. We often stop with just starting our sentences with I, but he says, also use it after the word because. Let me give you an example. Instead of saying, I feel angry because you, say, I feel angry because I, right? What is going on? You know, I feel angry because I need greater financial security. I feel, you know, sad because I need to feel safer, or I feel harmed. You know, so that double I statement can really take a huge next step in nonviolent communication and really forcing you to look inside yourself and be honest and vulnerable about that. So again, slow down, observe without judgment, and acknowledge the limitations of your first-person perspective and be honest about what's going on inside yourself. Moving on to step two is to name the emotional elephant in the room. And that's part of that turning that jackal language into the giraffe language, right? Take the broader perspective and name the emotional elephant in the room. And if being in touch with your emotions is not your strong point, I can print out a chart for you and we can work on that. But you can go a long way in the right direction in what some psychologists call the four basic emotions. There are many more emotions, if you were not aware of that. I can give you some words for those. But you can get a long way with just these four. Look inside yourself, and are you mad, sad, glad, or feeling bad? Mad, sad, glad, or bad. Now, bad really means scared, but scared doesn't rhyme with the other three. So we say bad. Mad, sad, glad, and bad. What's going on inside of you? I first learned a version of this practice more than a decade ago, and I've repeatedly experienced the palpable shift that can happen in the room to a much deeper register when communication moves from shouting these interpretations, these judgmental interpretations back and forth, to someone naming the emotional elephant in the room. You just feel this chunk. You just feel this shift in the room to a much deeper level. When even one person stops armoring themselves with defensive rationalizations and is vulnerable enough to say, right now I'm feeling really scared, or I'm feeling really mad, or I'm feeling really unsafe. So to name the emotional elephant in the room, I'm feeling really sad. Some of you may remember back in the election sermon I did back in November, I talked about Jonathan Haidt's research about the righteous mind, and when we battle between the left and the right, he talks about the elephant and the rider problem, that the rider is our reason. Imagine a human being on top of an elephant, right? He said the rider is our reason, and the elephant is our emotions. And so when you're having this battle of just interpretations going back, it's these two riders shouting on top of each other, and they're ignoring the elephants. And so when you shift it, name the emotional elephant in the room. And there can really be a transformation and an opening in which transformation can have a chance to take place. And that's the second step in nonviolent communication. At this point, I should also mention that my favorite part of Rosenberg's middle step is his description of the ironically violent evolution many of us go through in becoming more adept at nonviolent communication and emotional literacy. Some of you may have seen this happen. The most important point is the initial insight. You heard some of the AVP prison inmates testifying about this, of realizing that you don't have to be responsible for other people's feelings. That's amazingly powerful. Someone's bucking up on you and just being able to realize, that's actually that person's stuff, not my stuff. And being that's a huge insight. And Rosenberg calls that initial insight liberation from emotional slavery, being enslaved anytime anybody else does anything. Unfortunately, with the zeal of the convert, many of us pass through an initial obnoxious stage, you may have seen this, in which you tend to hear the not quite fully nonviolent exchanges such as, that's your problem, I'm not responsible for your feelings, you know, said with nonviolence and said with compassion and love. No. Over time, as you practice this more and more, you tend to experience a healthier differentiation. You're not as fused with others. And from that more differentiated place, you can express that emotional liberation from other people more compassionately instead of that middle obnoxious phase. So be on the lookout for that. Now, I mentioned earlier that there's often a profound shift that happens when a conflict moves from interpretation to feelings. But to have the greatest chance of lasting change, you need the third and final step of naming the real need that's underneath our feelings and at the root of the conflict. A classic example of why this final step is vital is the story of the spouse who asked her partner to spend less time at work. 3 weeks later, he responded by, I took your advice. I signed up for a golf tournament. She should have said, I need you to spend more time at home with me and the children, right? So failing to articulate the real underlying need of I'm feeling lonely, I'm feeling abandoned, right? That often results in passive aggression and fruitless miscommunication. All this being said, if you begin experimenting with some of these techniques of nonviolent communication, you'll find it's most difficult to practice, unfortunately, with those we love most, those we spend the most time with, those we're closest to. As you've heard me say before in a proverb that's most appropriate for the holiday season, our families can most easily push our buttons because our families sewed our buttons on in the first place. And so if you want to start to loosen some of those buttons and start to untie them and become more emotionally liberated, naming our feelings and the underlying needs are important steps toward being increasingly filled with loving kindness for yourself and others, increasingly being peaceful and at ease, increasingly being well in more and more times and places. And if you suddenly wake up, even if you've been trying this for a while, and you suddenly wake up, you stumbled into a habitual pattern, especially with those you love, that is falling short of the ideals of nonviolent communication, I invite you to stop and say to yourself, WAIT. Now, does anybody, I've said this before, does anybody remember what does the acronym WAIT stand for? What is it?
Why am I talking?
Say to yourself, you know, you're in the middle of going down a violent, escalatingly violent road. Why am I talking? WAIT. Stop. Take a few breaths. Move away from the source of conflict if you need to. But then challenge yourself. And this is what nonviolent communication can help you do. Dave gave the example, or maybe Nancy actually gave the example of the inmate who went back to the officer and had a one-on-one conversation. So to later go back to re-engage and experiment with that nonviolent communication of observing without judgment, to name the emotional elephant in the room, and to look inside yourself to discern the real need. And it sounds like that inmate did that, and by exposing the feelings inside of, he made himself a human being to that officer and transformed their relationship. as Danielle said earlier, words can be windows or words can be walls. So to allow those words that you use, the nonviolent communication, to be a window into your heart and to open up into the heart of another. So even as we continue to work with partner organizations such as the UU Legislative Ministry to make systemic changes in our society, may we also not forget to more immediately do what we can with what we can control immediately, which is inside ourselves, which is our part of the interactions we have with people every day. In so doing, may we each do our part in hastening the day when we may lay down our burden, when we may lay down our sword and shield, and study war no more.